I'm going to call the meeting unofficially to order because it is 8:15 and some seconds thereafter. And we have much business to accomplish in our short session. So we do not have a quorum, as you know, but I will begin to talk about what is ahead for us and probably first begin by introducing our pages. So Laura and Ben, will you come forward? Or Paige?
Hi there. I am Will. I paged in 2013 and 2014. Spent the last couple years at the Northern Star Council Boy Scouts in St. Paul, and I'm back this year. So I appreciate and I look forward to being on the committee.
And I apologize, Will. I called you Ben, who was our page last year, the year before. Thank you, Will. Is Laura in the room? She'll be coming shortly. So members, we'll introduce, we have a new member, Representative Flanagan, too, I hope will be joining us. Oh, here comes. Laura, can you just step to the microphone over here and say a little bit about yourself as our page?
Good morning. My name is Laura Lee Runia, and I'm really happy to be here.
Thank you, Laura. We're great. So happy to have you. So, excuse me?
We all have to have that amount of caffeine.
Yes. Members, because we are having probably essentially five meetings only, be prepared to meet nights, including next Tuesday. So listen for announcements when I begin meetings each day, because we have lots to get done, and you know, we always like to really vet our bills very thoroughly, and with that said, I know it's going to take us more time. So be prepared. The meetings will be in this room. And they will be at 5 o'clock or 20 to 30 minutes after session adjourns. So keep that in mind. We can't officially begin, I don't think. Well, yeah. Do I have a quorum? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9.
Who's excused?
Who's excused? Oh, sure. But there we are. We have a quorum, so we're official. I'll call this meeting officially to order and remind all of you that we have two new pages, Will and Laura, and that we will be prepared to meet evenings beginning next Tuesday, possibly. So watch the calendar and watch for what is on the agenda. We won't introduce our new member until she arrives, but we do have Representative Peggy Flanagan joining us. And members, today we are going to get an update on the new federal law called Every Student Succeeds Act from the department, as well as an update on the world's best workforce and an update on our innovation projects. So with that said, let's do the minutes, okay? Representative Lucero, will you move the minutes for December 1? First of all, because you were present.
Madam Chair, so moved.
Representative Lucero moves the minutes of December 1, 2015 that were held in room 200. It was part of our interim hearings. Is there any discussion, corrections, or additions? Hearing none, all those in a favor of approving the minutes, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, say no. The motion prevails, and the minutes are adopted for December 1. February 25, 2016, another interim meeting. Representative Christensen, you were present?
Madam Chair, move the minutes.
Representative Christensen moves the minutes of February 25, 2016, held in room 200 of the State Office Building. Are there any corrections or additions? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The motion prevails and the minutes are adopted. Thank you very much, members, and welcome to the table. Very good to have both of you. Some of you have heard presentations from both of our presenters this morning at a meeting that we had not too long ago, but we are so glad to inform the entire committee. Welcome, Commissioner, and welcome, Stephanie. What's your last name?
Stephanie Graff.
Graff,
sure.
That's right.
Yep.
And Ms. Graff. So, whoever wants to begin, please say your name for the record and begin.
Great. Brenda Caselius, Commissioner of Education. Thank you, Madam Chair, for inviting me here today to give you a brief update on the No Child Left Behind Act revision and reauthorization into what's now called the Every Student Succeeds Act. And then I will speak briefly again about the world's best workforce, and then I think you have other business, and then Darren Cordy will come up and give an update on our innovation zone law and maybe some recommendations for how that could be strengthened, especially given the new opportunities under the Every Student Succeeds Act. I want to thank the members and you, Madam Chair, for coming to the department just a few weeks ago to discuss the Every Student Succeeds Act, and we outlined quite a bit there and gave you a lot of technical information at that time. We have begun our process of stakeholder engagement. We have several groups set up who want to be part of that over the next several months. We anticipate, like I said, at that meeting in May to get some further guidance from the U.S. Department of Education, where then we will really develop a framework to take across the entire state and get feedback from a broad base of stakeholders. So I have a short PowerPoint for you today that outlines some of the key principles within the Every Student Succeeds Act, as well as just a little refresher on what was in the No Child Left Behind Act, also a refresher what is in our world's best workforce legislation, and how really we can streamline some of these state statutes and federal law to make it easier for districts in which to navigate their strategic planning, their budget allocation, and their efforts strategically to increase student achievement for all students, as well as really address some of these nagging disparities that we have in Minnesota. So I'm going to go ahead and get started, and Stephanie could maybe add a few things here or there if I'm moving too fast, or if, for further clarification. Stephanie serves at the department as our Chief Accountability Officer, working very closely with schools on their World's Best Workforce plans, as well as federal accountability, and is our federal liaison to the U.S. Department of Education. And so she's very knowledgeable on these topics.
So, Ms. Graff, why don't you introduce yourself formally at this point so that you can interject when necessary?
Thank you. Stephanie Graff, Chief Accountability Officer from the Minnesota Department of Education.
And thank you very much for being here and for your very good work at the department.
She's absolutely a star.
We agree.
Yes.
Please proceed, Commissioner.
So just an introduction to ESSA. You'll have it behind me here. It was signed by President Obama on December 10, 2015. I'd like to just formally thank the Health Committee members, Senator Al Franken, and also Chair Congressman Klein for passing in the House. Their incredible work was essential to moving this bill in Congress. As you know, it was stalled for quite a long time and much overdue. I'm so glad that they were able to get that done, and then President Obama signed it on December 10th. It does preserve some of the same goals and priorities as No Child Left Behind, and provides states with a lot more autonomy and authority over how we intervene with schools and hold them accountable, especially district accountability. An upcoming regulatory process will inform states and systems for how to do that. And like I said, in May, we'll get the final guidance from the U.S. Department of Education. Well, No Child Left Behind had an emphasis on disaggregation of public reported data. All schools and districts in the country were held accountable in the same way, using adequate yearly progress. And it's mentioned in our state law quite a bit, because we aligned our state law to federal accountability and have adequate yearly progress named in state law. So you'll see in our policy bill when we present it that there will be a number of cleanup items, technical language to align with the new law. School improvement strategies and consequences were prescribed in federal law, and the law expired in 2007. Minnesota, fortunately, was one of the first 10 states to receive a waiver from No Child Left Behind in 2012. However, we didn't waive any of the core, real underlying principles of No Child Left Behind, nor did we waive the accountability. The biggest changes that Minnesota did under its waiver was the way that we support our schools and the way that we identify schools by using also growth measures rather than just straight proficiency measures. We do use proficiency measures, but we also incorporated growth measures as well as an achievement gap measure for the first time And as far as I know, we're the only state that does provide an achievement gap measure for every single school in the state. So that was a huge start for us back in 2012. And we have only been at it now for a very short time. So the principles that they asked in the waivers was that we had college and career-ready standards. Minnesota had been well along its way with 2007 math standards, adoption of the ELA Common Core in 2010, all of this with the previous administration, and we have not changed standards in math or ELA since the previous administration. We do have two new math tests. The first math test was given in 2011. That was right away when I became commissioner. So it was developed under the previous administration, and then a new English-aligned test that we gave for the first time, I believe, in 2013.
Yes.
And so school districts are now getting used to these standards and moving toward proficiency in the standards and their instructional pedagogy and differentiation to be able to address all of the unique needs that come to them in the classroom. I'll talk a little bit about math toolkits. Let me put a note and I'll make sure I talk with the committee about math toolkit, which is a really new tool we're going to be using to help our schools around math achievement. You also had to have a recognition and accountability and support system. Minnesota had a system of working with cooperatives around school improvement that was mostly just approving plans and very little strategic support and technical assistance to schools. And what we did under the waiver was really strengthen that system through regional centers of excellence, partnering with the Minnesota Department of Education, and working collaboratively and alongside schools. We've presented several times in front of this committee about regional centers of excellence and the success that they're having within mostly our rural and suburban schools to improve student achievement and close gaps. And then thirdly, there was teacher and principal evaluation required under the waiver. And in 2011, we were able to pass teacher and principal evaluation with the principal evaluation starting the next year and the teacher evaluation starting the following year. And so both teacher and principal evaluation systems are in place currently. All school districts have them. But again, those systems are not currently funded outside of QComp. And a very small amount to one-time money to teachers for that. So area of improvement is probably around teacher and principal evaluation and systems and supporting them and supporting districts. ESSA, Every Student Succeeds Act, has assessment and data reporting. It still requires annual testing in the exact same grades 3 through 8, and once in high school, in both reading and math, and it requires science at grade span, so once in elementary, middle, and high school. 1% statewide cap on the participation in alternate assessments. We're no longer allowed to provide modified assessments, but there is a 1% state cap on participation in alternate assessments for students who have the need for those. New data reporting requirements on the state report include things like foster care, homeless students, military-affected students, and we're still trying to figure out the guidance around that and how we would collect that information from school districts and report that out.
Excuse me, Commissioner, but will you be also reporting, and maybe you already do, but I think this is new, those enrolled, the numbers enrolled in concurrent enrollment?
That's coming. Yes, we could. We do report that out to the legislature already multiple reports, but it's having it be part of our accountability system will be determined by that stakeholder engagement group. There is a third indicator under the new accountability system, which I'm getting to right now, that you have the opportunity to include a college and career ready measure, which could be participation in AP, IB, or concurrent enrollment or PSEO or something like that. Or it could be a score on the ACT or, it's up for the stakeholder group to decide how to, what that third measure is. It can also be used for socio-emotional indicators or disposition or other factors within the school could be also used for that third indicator. The third indicator is for the state to determine. I'd like to see something done around equity and that we would work with our schools and hold our schools accountable for providing opportunities and removing barriers for greater equity of opportunity in schools. So that's going to be discussed quite in depth at the stakeholder engagement meetings over the next several months. So let's talk about accountability. And so we will set a state long-term goal, and we have to then report out on the interim progress and measurements for this accountability. Accountability measures include achievement, and they include growth, graduation rates, English proficiency, and at least one other measure, which we just discussed. Now, these are things that are very familiar to us. We have the multiple measurements rating we've been using that incorporates proficiency, and it incorporates growth and graduation rates for our high schools. We also have the focus rating, which is this achievement gap measure that we talked about that takes our most underperforming students and protected class students and looks at their achievements solely. So I'll get to some of that data in just a few minutes on some charts. So we're not, because we took our waiver really seriously, we're not that far away from the requirements already required under ESSA. And I think, you know, as I go around and talk to teachers, and I've been able to visit the 44 reward schools, which has been absolutely amazing, and I'll talk about that in a little bit. I'm hoping that the stakeholder group will not change too much on our teachers, that we will be able to move forward with systems and maybe tweak systems here or there to better look at equity and excellence and address achievement gaps in a more accelerated way, an intentional way and deliberate way, and get greater growth out of our students faster. So we'll see what comes out of the stakeholder group. Schools are still expected to reach 95% test participation, and currently consequences for that include not being able to be a reward school, for instance, if your school falls below the 95% test participation.
Madam Chair, Commissioner from the Madam Chair, will that affect those also who might want to participate in PSCO? Do you know of anything in regard to that? I read some blogs. I mean, I read a lot of blogs, and that was brought up in a blog.
I'm not certain, Madam Chair, how that would affect PSCO. PSCO students are still required to take the state tests for federal accountability, so...
But if they've chosen to opt out, would that affect?
Yes, opting out does affect.
Yes, I guess that's what I wanted
yes,
to ask.
Opting out does yes. affect your participation
yes.
rate.
Thank you.
Yes. Okay, so as a school support, states identify the bottom 5%. This wasn't codified in law before under No Child Left Behind, but it was as part of the waiver. And we have been doing this for several years under our waiver and intervening through our regional centers of excellence and identifying priority and focus schools. Our priority schools are the schools that are in the lowest 5%, and our focus schools are those 10% of schools with the largest achievement gaps. We also, under the new ESSA, must intervene with high schools that have a grad rate below 67%. Now, many of you probably read or heard the NPR article on graduation rates. There's good news, and there's still work to be done on our graduation rates. For many years, our graduation rates were very stagnant and had not moved. Matter of fact, the 5 years prior to this administration, they had only moved about 1 or 2%. And under this administration, they've moved 6% overall. But black students, for instance, have moved 15.6 percentage points, and Hispanic students have moved 17.8 percentage points in their graduation rates. And all student groups have increased their graduation rates, somewhere from 7.7 all the way up to the 17.8 Hispanic students. So tremendous growth. Why do I think this is happening in our graduation rates, and why do I think there's growth? Because under our No Child Left Behind waiver, for the very first time, we counted more students. Because Minnesota is a rural state comparatively to so many other states, we had many small schools that did not have 40 students in their graduating class. Mm-hmm. Therefore, high schools that had less than 40 students did not get a graduation rate. So if you're not getting a graduation rate, well, then you're not being held accountable for your graduation rate. Also, they only got one rate. So if you had 41 students or more in your high school, you got one graduation rate. But if you had, of those 41 to 100 students or whatever you had in your graduating class, if you had kids of color or poor kids in that graduating class, you did not get a graduation rate for those poor kids or those kids of color. We now report out 10. So, and we hold you accountable for 20. So I think that that has changed the mindset. You would read local papers, and they would just say, oh, yeah, you know, Brainerd Public Schools has a graduation rate of 90%. And it never before said, but their poor kids are graduating at 65% or something like that. Now, that's not what's at Brainerd. That's just an example. But so now with that, they can really count kids. We've also instituted the MERS program, which is early indicator program, Minnesota Early Indicators for graduation program, and so and for readiness. And so school districts are using this more and more to understand and identify kids all the way to sixth grade on whether they are at risk for not graduating and they're able to intervene earlier. We also have, I think, 27 schools that fall below the 65% graduation rate that we have been intentionally working with and convening them to talk about best practices and trying to help them with their graduation rates. And so some of this work has just started in the past 2 years with these high schools under our waiver. And so some of that work, I think we're starting to see the movement, but we need to do even more around our graduation rates. And so that's kind of where we are with graduation rates.
Commissioner, we have a couple of questions. Representative Brand, is this relevant?
Yes.
Or do you want to wait?
I hope so.
Representative Brand.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner, so in regards to accountability measurements and growth and graduation rate, what's the impact on that for chartered public schools where there are, where many of the population have not succeeded in the traditional school settings and there's many barriers to, you know, to be proficient?
Commissioner?
Madam Chair, Representative Moran, charter schools are under the exact same accountability system as any public school. So we work with them with our regional centers. We haven't seen as much success. I just actually met with charter school authorizers last week, talking with them and challenging them around the support system and what can we do differently, because our regional centers are seeing success in our rural schools and inner suburban schools, but we haven't seen that similar kind of success in our charter schools disproportionately. And so we need to figure out a different model for that. And so we're trying to unpack some of that performance issue and work with our charter authorizers as well.
Thank you.
Representative Bennett.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Commissioner, for being here.
Yeah.
Question, I had a teacher approach me a number of months ago with this question. When students are special needs students, you know, say mentally handicapped and so on, and some districts keep those students longer, you know, past their 18 years, is it up to age 21
yes.
they can stay?
Mm-hmm.
How does that affect the graduation rate? This teacher was concerned that it made the district look bad even though they were keeping those students for a purpose.
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative Bennett, this is such a great question, and thank you for joining me on the Reward School visit the other week. This is a huge problem. I'm actually trying to work with Mr. Uden at the U.S. Department of Education around special ed students. We have a program called Transition Plus, which is a program that really does help special ed students transition into workplace and into getting career skills. Mm-hmm. But they're considered then a continuing student, and that then does work against your graduation rate. Even though they may have earned all of their credits under Minnesota state law and what's required, or their IEP team has determined that they have met the requirements of their IEP in which to get their diploma, it still works against their graduation rate. I think we have an opportunity within the new ESSA to really push on how we calculate graduation rate, especially for special needs students or students that we determine need additional support who may even enter into our secondary or post-secondary system. We in Minnesota are very unique in that we offer public education to students up to age 21. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, Madam Chair, you've been a teacher. We have several folks on the panel who have been teachers or worked on school boards. We know that kids develop at their mm-hmm. own pace. And I'd much rather see a student stay with us an additional year and get support and help and potentially earn an associate's degree through some really cool career pathway program with our post-secondary institution, rather than a high school feeling as though, no, I have to graduate them because otherwise my four-year graduation rate will go down. So we do use 5- and 6-year rates, but that's never what's reported. And so I think we need to think a little bit deeper, and this session may be too short to really think about it, but as a state, how do we want to support our students right there at graduation and moving into post-secondary so that many of them are will attend post-secondary, attend the special needs programs that they need for to get the career skills, and we still support that development and it doesn't become a disincentive to our schools to move them out quicker simply because it will improve their graduation rate.
So Representative Yarusso, follow up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Do you have a feel for how much of the improvement in graduation rates is accounted for by rolling in those schools between 10 and 40 kids?
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative Yarusso, I don't, but I can. We can look at that. We can certainly get you that information and how many more schools are included. At the state level, we include all kids. Right. If you had one graduate, it comes to the state level. My point for talking about school accountability, though, is that certainly at the state level, we'll see the scores, and it will go against our scores at the state level, and it's always been accounted for at the state level data. But if schools don't see their own participation in the state level data, and because we're all a team here, so they have to do their little part, then if there's not that accountability, then they don't know what data to look at. And so by providing the data, making it transparent, by school districts and school boards understanding and knowing, and then it being reported publicly, I think that they feel a pressure to, you know, make sure every kid gets a diploma across their stage.
Please proceed, Commissioner. Okay.
So we were talking about school support and the regional centers, and states may permit for differentiated improvement activities for high schools focused on dropout or credit recovery. So we're trying to unpack that and see what that means. We've had a number of like high school recording arts has come before this board before, looking at how do they fit our second chance schools, how do they fit into the accountability system. So we'll be spending some time really going deeper into that with the stakeholder group. An educator evaluation is permitted, but it is no longer required by federal law. So there's some work to do there. So the planning timetable for ESSA is to, again, we've met with you, we've met with the large stakeholder group, and now we'll have topic area meetings. Some of these topics include standards and assessment, accountability, school improvement, data collection, early learning, English learners, family engagement, social-emotional learning, foster care, homeless youth, and guidance regarding title programs and requirements. And so there's a lot that has to be covered, and so we will be looking and unpacking all of this over the next several months. We'll get the guidance in May, and then all summer long work toward a framework that works for Minnesota schools. So I want to talk about the opportunity we have in front of us to align state and federal systems. Because we have a strong waiver that is now being understood, because we have world's best workforce, which is now being understood, and I said in the Senate just a few weeks ago that I believe the strategic planning is very good, and now school districts are maturing in their ability to do the strategic planning, and they've been getting technical assistance and support from our office, as well as the Minnesota Association for School Boards and school administrators have held convenings and regional meetings, and they're working to have more stronger, I would say, strategic planning going on in their school districts. So We have built a world's best workforce goals around accountability goals and support, and those are common goals. So we have the opportunity to align both world's best workforce goals and ESSA. ESSA currently only holds title schools accountable, and world's best workforce holds all schools accountable. I think that Minnesota has a difficult time with its achievement gap because 50% of our schools are not held accountable. If you don't accept title funding, you have never, ever been held accountable. And our kids of color, our kids who speak other languages, our special ed kids, our poor kids, they're in all our schools. They're in all our schools. And so, to me, it only makes sense that every single school in Minnesota ought to be held accountable to the high standards that we expect and that this body sets out for them, and that every child succeeds, no matter what your zip code or where you live or if your school accepts funding for poverty or not. World's Best Workforce includes all districts, and we have a stronger system under the World's Best Workforce. You know that there's a trigger next year coming with the World's Best Workforce, that if you do not meet your goals, the commissioner has the authority in which to work alongside you and set aside up to 2% of your general ed funding to more aggressively meet your goals. And that was work that was done out of the 2013 session to really look at an accountability system that had a little bit of teeth in it that would allow for that collaboration to happen and not continue to allow schools to be struggling. I'm going to go through in just a few minutes on what I think that might look like in the future. So the World's Best Workforce goals are around every step. It's nothing revolutionary and that schools aren't doing anyway. It's that students are ready for kindergarten, that third graders are proficient in reading, that we close achievement gaps, that all students graduate from high school, and that when they graduate from high school, they are college and career ready and they don't have to take remedial education. All public and charter schools are included in World's Best Workforce as well. So the process is the school boards will adopt a comprehensive long-term strategic plan to support teaching and learning. It's not submitted to the department. They are to publish an annual report reflecting on the previous year and the planning moving forward. That too is not submitted to MDE, but it is expected it will be posted on their website and made public. They are to hold an annual public meeting reflecting on the previous year's progress and then anything they want to do to more accelerate meeting their goals. What we do ask to be submitted and is required by law is a brief summary of the annual report reflecting on the previous year. We have developed a template. Superintendents have told me this is very easy to use, and it's just telling us did they or did they not meet their goals, what were their goals, and what is it that they're doing to work toward their goals. So it is really a brief summary. I think we have a copy of that template in your packet. We didn't bring. We'll make sure we get you a copy of the template in your packet so that you have a copy of that.
So, Commissioner, have many districts had to adjust their goals based on what is actually happening in regard to learning in their districts?
I would say at least half have had to go in and adjust, and I would say probably more have adjusted. They should adjust it throughout the year. It should be a living document. Everybody in the district ought to know what things are that they're working on, where the dollars are going, how their interventions are working with students who are not achieving, how their interventions are working for their highly gifted students who need additional acceleration. And when I go into these 44 reward schools, the 30 that are four-time reward schools and the 14 that are five-time reward schools, and some of you have been on those visits with me, thank you for coming. Absolutely hands down amazing places, and they all know these teachers are singing from the same song sheet. They all know where they're headed, what they're doing, where they're going, how they're working with kids. Every kid is counted. They're absolutely amazing places. They support one another. They said they feel like a family. They don't let each other fail. They don't always agree on everything, but they work through healthy conflict, and it's just amazing. They work with their parents, their communities. Very amazing places to be, and children are thriving. Children are thriving in other schools, too, that aren't four- and five-time reward schools across Minnesota, and I've been in hundreds of those. We have amazing schools, and I think the missing piece is for us in getting all of our kids to the place of excellence and equity is really the strategic planning, and it's ensuring that all schools are doing this as strategic planning and all schools are getting good feedback. Just like teacher evaluation, you have to have good, strong feedback in which to improve. And I think that that's what we've been building over the past several years through our regional centers and technical assistance, Stephanie's leadership on making sure they understand the data, and being able to have districts be more strategic and deliberate about the work that they do with our children.
So Commissioner, do you think that parents are engaged enough to understand what's going on now in regard to the strategic plan? I hear bits and pieces of, you know, ignorance out there, or naivety, or, you know, being left out. So, you know, I'm very concerned, and I think we all are, that parents actually are engaged in this.
Madam Chair, I think in some districts the answer is absolutely. You know, Elk River, Bloomington, these are really outstanding examples of where World's Best Workforce is happening. Montemita, Moundsview, you know, these districts are just out there with their community and very public. They've developed web pages for their public. I think it's maturing. And I mean, I just really think, like anything new, it takes a while. I personally thought that maybe some superintendents, and I've been a superintendent, think that this is one of those things that will come and go, you know. But I think that strategic planning is just good leadership. It's just good leadership. And I think some of our superintendents and school boards are now getting handle on how to do good strategic planning. And that just, it's still taking hold for some. I have some examples a little later on some of the SMART goals, for instance, and making SMART goals, where some districts are well ahead, have had very formalized training in making SMART goals, and then some are still have pretty fuzzy goals, like we'll just improve the education of all students, rather than saying, you know, which students you need to, you know, address, and what your difficulties are that you're having, and what resources you might be using so that you can actually achieve, and how you implement that. I'd like to think that everybody's there, but I do think we're still maturing.
Please proceed.
Okay, World's Best Workforce Outreach and Support. We've, through October 13 and February 14th, we had over 800 participants. This is this maturing process where we've, you know, presented at all of the association meetings, the superintendents conferences. I've led those. Hundreds of one-to-one technical assistance to districts. I went to the road this past fall, met with regional superintendents, gave them their regional data, broke that down for them. I know you came to one of those meetings, Madam Chair. We had several legislators who came to some of those meetings. Very informative, giving them feedback on these goals and where the state was at with these goals, as well as their region and their district. And we showed them everybody's data. And so that they then could see, oh, geez, my colleague over here is getting really good results in third grade. That must be Ms. Anderson, who's teaching third grade. Can you help me with my third grade scores? And the whole purpose is around collaboration and around getting districts sharing across hallways and across districts and across the state. And that's the way that we're going to move the entire state. And then we've had multiple legislative hearings in both bodies over the past couple of sessions, as well as a formalized reporting. So last year, districts did not use a standard format. We've provided more meaningful feedback through our template I mentioned earlier. These summaries were due December 1. We did have several districts that we prodded to get the summaries in. We still have, I think, six outstanding or something like that. Okay, well, six regular districts and and like 14 charters or something like that. But they've either had a change in leadership or some reason why they haven't been able to get it in, and they've had to do more work, and it was a bigger undertaking for them. So we've been trying to be flexible. The first round of feedback went back this past week, and we have those folks who got it in a little late to us. They should get their feedback over the next several weeks. And so our office has really worked to try to provide meaningful feedback to districts. It still is only meaningful as well as the summary was. So if the summary was vague and didn't provide enough information on it, then it was harder for us to provide good feedback to the district. So we've had a couple superintendents write back and say, you know, I don't understand this feedback, and then Stephanie will work with them personally one-on-one and help them better understand what was missing on that. So the measures school districts have flexibility to establish their own World's Best Workforce goals and benchmarks. They can use local or state metrics. Many districts chose to use local measures like NWEA scores or maybe some other reading scores, literacy scores, or AR scores, or whatever it was that they were using. So they were able to make those their own goals. But we requested that they be smart, that they be specific enough, that they're measurable, that they're attainable, they're results-based, and they're time-bound. And so we wanted to make sure that we don't have school districts saying, well, since we can make our own goals, we'll just grow by 1%. And you know that students are achieving a 35% proficiency. The reason that we have localized goals and the reason we have a public hearing and the reason we want parents engaged, Madam Chair, is so that the local community will hold them accountable to high standards and highly rigorous goal setting, not a low bar. I did have a couple superintendents who shared with me that they had set low goals because they want to be able to meet them, and I pushed on them and asked them to work with their communities around their goal setting. So that's very rare. I want to say most are setting ambitious goals because they still take title money, and if you take title funding, you have targets that are very ambitious and rigorous, and you're going to have to meet those federal goals anyways. So many of our districts are setting high goals. So here's just a simple example of some of the differences around the maturity, Madam Chair. You can see here that some say they want to increase participation in ECFE learning opportunities by 2% between 2014 and 2015. That's time bound. It has a specific measure to it. It's talking about a specific strategy. But I don't know with this example if 2% is going to be enough to get them where they need to go for kindergarten readiness. On the achievement gap closure side, we will use data to identify instructional needs of all students. Well, if I'm a superintendent and I'm looking at my district, I may not have American Indian students, but I may have a large population of Somali students, and I'm going to want to be able to have EL strategies and take a focus on Somali students if they're underachieving. If they're not, then I would not focus there. I'd focus on something else. So you should be looking at your data, understanding what your data is telling you, because that's telling you if your strategies are working, and then if your strategies aren't working, what new strategies will you use in the next year, and you work with your school board, your teachers, and your community, your parents, to determine how that money is spent and how you move forward. But we here don't tell them what the goals are.
Representative Bly, you have a question relevant to this?
Yes, thank
Please
you.
Please proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner, I wondered, do you have the sense that the school setting these high goals have the resources to meet them? I guess I'm concerned that they may recognize that there are some great needs and that they want to set those goals high to improve, but it may cost them something that they have to take from somewhere else in order to meet the goals that they set. Do you have confidence they have the resources they need?
Commissioner?
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Bly, I think you guys will know my answer to this one, just as commissioner, and I think the superintendents would probably not be happy with me if I said they have plenty of resources. I think that they absolutely could use more resources, right? I mean, I don't think we've met to the level of inflation, even with the increases we've made over the past 4 years and 5 years. School districts still are strapped for paying for teachers and paying for the things that they need. And there's certainly not enough. I've come to this body for several years asking for additional revenue for regional centers to be able to provide the technical assistance that school districts need for this kind of school improvement work. It's hard. It's hard work to meet the needs of every kid. And it does require additional resources, and those resources have to come from somewhere. There's a greater burden on those school districts that have a larger special ed cross subsidy. You all know that, because we don't fully fund special ed, so then, you know, any of the dollars that are used to fund special ed come off the general ed formula. Or if we have steps and lanes and you're doing teacher increases and settling contracts that you have to settle, then that eats away at all of the additional revenue that we were able to put into public education earlier. So I feel good that the body paid back the borrowing of $2.8 billion. I feel good that we've invested about $1.4 billion in our schools. And it seems like, gosh, that should be enough, but it just isn't. If we're going to really meet our ambitious goals, it just isn't.
Representative Black.
Yes, thank you, Chair. I also wanted to, I guess, ask you about not only revenue resources, which I think you explained are necessary and probably need to be increased somehow. But also, there may be a need for teachers either with a certain kind of expertise or a certain kind of background that may not be available right now. And how, as I mean, that's a challenge to the state, not just to these schools. But how, do you have any thoughts about how we can improve that situation? I mean, I think part of the solving the achievement gap problem is also having teachers who understand the cultural differences and can meet those needs as well.
Commissioner.
Madam Chair and Representative Bly, these are really good questions and things that we hope this planning process actually spurs, and that these conversations happen in school districts about their specific students and the needs that are needed within the context of that community. And so those are the local decisions that need to be happening. We can certainly provide new categorical aids. I mean, we know we are woefully underfunded for counselors, for instance. And we know that counselors would help us improve our graduation rates, because the number one thing for why students don't graduate is that they get behind in ninth grade in credits. There's study after study after study that show, and if you had counselors there, enough counselors who were looking at whether kids are failing behind earlier, then you could catch them earlier and provide the right kind of interventions. What I see is an opportunity. We have ATSIS funding, so when I go in the reward schools, we have a number of schools using ATSIS funding for that early intervention, so kids do not end up being referred for special education. So we see they're using that for ATSIS. We see multi-tiered systems of support types of training that districts are using, RTI models to do intervention. Most of the reward schools had some sort of intervention specialist. They also have reprogrammed their day for like win hour or flex hour, where kids are getting the intervention or enrichment that they need. Our actual MMR accounts for kids who are high achieving. Before, under proficiency, you're just proficient, doesn't matter if you grow or not. Now, if you have a kid who's already scoring proficient, they're a high-achieving student, but they don't grow a year's of growth, that counts against you in your MMR. And so I think that, you know, every kid is counting now, and it's a different way to look at your data. It's a different way to understand student growth and what that means. And that does require a different skill set and more professional development. So, but I do think that those are local matters. Those are things that we can help provide technical assistance through our regional centers or through the department. And our organizations have been great about doing training and professional development. There can always be more.
Commissioner, is the governor keen to what you're showing on this PowerPoint slide, and so we'll see it reflected in the supplemental budget?
Well, as you know, this is supplemental year. So, Madam Chair, and I think he laid out yesterday in his State of the State address that his goal is to really keep Minnesota on a good financial footing. And so I believe that his proposals coming forward will be proposals that will be targeted in ways that can support learning in our schools. And it will be very much like what he's proposed in the past and his priorities.
Please proceed.
So World's Best Workforce Data Profiles, we have these links here that you can go in and you can see what I presented to superintendents around their data so that they had their data. Also, there's regional data included there. So if you turn the page, you can see that there's a map that shows these different regions. There are 11 of them. So you can find your region and then go into the data and look at every single one of your schools and how they are performing on these measures if you click on that link. So you'll be able to see it. All the school districts got this information. It's public. It's publicly available on our website and available for everybody to see. So I'm going to move ahead because we're, I don't know how time is going. World's Best Workforce Data Profiles.
Excuse me, Commissioner. I think we have a question here. Representative Huber, so is this relevant right now?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm not certain about the timing, but I've been mulling over the data here. When we look at the four-year graduation rates, looking at the numbers of total district counts, we have 300. Well, I'm looking at the four-year graduation rates. I'm not sure about my timing talking about this one.
I don't think we have them here. Okay.
Have we not
Perhaps we should wait for that.
Wait for that? Okay.
Yes. Thank you.
My question really...
You're coming to that, Commissioner.
Right. Kind of preview it is when we look at total district counts, which of course you're doing because that's how you're setting the goals, it kind of obscures the total student counts. And we have large numbers of schools that have either very few or possibly no minority enrollment whatsoever. So my question is going to kind of center around that. Thanks.
Representative Ward.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would like to kind of go back to page 16, the slide on page 16, because it triggered in my mind the upper left one is about ECFE. Yes. And so if we go to the regional data profiles, will we get data on ECFE accessibility, availability, and how much, maybe a percentage of what districts are spending on ECFE? Mm-hmm. As we're needing to get ready for kindergarten, it can't just be at age 4 or age 3. Mm-hmm. We do need to start earlier, and since this is part of district profile, is that information available? And would that be on this? Thank you.
Madam Chair, Representative, there's not good information right now for kindergarten readiness, so we really do depend on local school districts to report out their preschool information. Most school districts are doing some kind of kindergarten assessment. Mm-hmm. But we don't have a clear path for that. We don't have a state assessment that everybody has to use. We are currently in a race to the top developing our kindergarten entry profile, which consists of about 4 different assessments that are most popularly used in our schools: work study, developmental, something, the FAST, and one other one. I can't think of all 4 of them now. And those will kind of bubble up to a profile on a student, and then we'll have the one kind of statewide indicator that does have a fiscal cost to it. So, we don't have that currently funded to do that work. So we just don't have that. Now, districts can choose to put in ECFE mm-hmm. information like this district did, because that was the best information that they had. But I do think that as we work toward our new accountability system, certainly that third indicator could be something around early learning, right? And it could be something around career and college ready. And it could be something around equity and that we ensure kids have a highly qualified teacher. So I think that the biggest opportunity for us as a state is what we include in that third indicator, and I'm going to recommend that be some sort of equity index that includes these things that are so important for opportunities for kids.
Representative Flanagan, welcome to our committee. We'll have you say a little bit about yourself either later today or the next meeting, but welcome. And you have a question.
I do. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner, I have a question. Since we came back to slide 16, I'm going to ask it. As we're looking at the achievement gap goals, as we have some of the largest gaps, right, in the country between white students of color and American Indian students, do you push back? Because I'm looking at some of these goals, they're not specific, we don't know how well, how much are we actually making a difference. It makes me nervous to say, we increase it. That's sort of a feel-good goal without any teeth. And so what does that look like when you get goals like this? How do you push back?
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative Flanagan, glad to have you here. I was able to work with you in Minneapolis, so that was wonderful. We do push back and talk through with superintendents around their goals, and that's through this feedback. And so they do get feedback, and we will share. That's not really a SMART goal, and we don't mean that like it's not a SMART goal, right? It's not in SMART format. We help to provide the technical assistance so that they can get them there. Like I said, they're maturing, and it's not that they don't have the goodwill and they want to get there. It really is mostly that they just don't, they lack the expertise in the strategic mm-hmm. planning process and understanding how to set these goals and really understand how to read data. I'm more and more amazed every day of really how folks and in our schools don't understand how to look at data. So I went out to every region with Stephanie and with Steve, And we sat down and went through the data with school district superintendents so that they did have an understanding. So, but it's more is needed. You know, we keep, if it's one-on-one, we provide it, and we're trying to also provide it in groups, and our associations also have been very helpful.
Please proceed.
Okay. And I think we are on
19.
Yep, slide 19. So these are the profiles that we have and what's included. So we have a menu of valid and reliable tools that districts can use, like I mentioned, for pre-kindergarten, but it's not available statewide. We have third grade growth and proficiency scores that we give because we do literacy aid that way. We also have closing the achievement gap, which is based on their MMR scores and looking at how students are growing and whether they're meeting their targets for cutting achievement gap by 50%, which is our federal goal by 2017, and I'll cover that in just a moment. And are they career and college ready? So we look at eighth grade math for this. It may be that we want to choose something different in the future, but that was the best kind of researched evidence that we could use for college and career readiness, given we don't still expect every school to do the ACT right now. It's not every student doesn't have to do that. All students graduate, and we've been using graduation rates, and our goal is 90% by 2020, with no student group being below 85%. Now, just for your information, I was asked by a reporter once recently about graduation rate and said, well, if you're only going to grow 1% or 2%, Commissioner, every year, how is it that you're going to get to your 90% goal? We're going to miss that by 2020. And I said, well, our eighth graders right now are our class of 2020. So I don't want to doom them before they even take one class in ninth grade. So there's no evidence to suggest that our eighth graders cannot achieve any goals that we set for them. And matter of fact, I think if we put in place the conditions for them to be successful in, we can reach our goal. So I just want to make that clear and on record. Let's look at the achievement gap here for just a minute. So if you look at third grade reading, and we look at the areas, you will notice that grade 3 proficiency, before we look at achievement gap, we're looking at grade 3 reading proficiency. You can see, for instance, the different groups in the left-hand column, grade 3 reading proficiency for 2013, this is just an example school district, what their proficiency goal is, their target, in this, and then where they actually were. Okay, so this is the kind of information we're giving to school districts and asking our superintendents to understand and unpack and then develop strategies. So if you go across the right column, you would see that your school district here is needing some support with LEP students. So we might go in and say, okay, how can we support you then with your students who need more support around English language learning? Okay. Then you look at the achievement gap, and we're looking at a school here that has just Hispanic, Black, and White students. The subject on the first two rows is reading. The third row is math. And we're looking at whether or not they've met their proficiency index. We do give credit, half credit, if they were able to partially meet proficiency. And a full credit, 1.0, for fully meeting proficiency. And so you'll see that their proficiency index was 55.62 for Hispanic students. Their target was 51.36. They have a positive difference of 4.26, meaning that they actually
exceeded,
met it, right? But then if you go down to their white students in math, they did not meet. And this is actually a trend that we see in our school districts. If you go to the next page, slide 22. So for instance, 59% of our districts are meeting their math targets for American Indian students, yet only 24% of districts are meeting their math targets for white students. And when I talk about this, people kind of give me a perplexed look. Well, white students are still expected to grow under our accountability system, and every child must grow. We will raise boats for everybody while raising faster those boats of kids who have been underperforming. And that's what we're seeing happen in our graduation rates. So we do see the trends working in our favor for graduation rates. White student growth is slower, but it's growing. It's up, ticking. But for kids of color, it's growing even faster, exponentially faster. That's what we need to see happen in math and in reading and in all our subjects within our schools. And so you can see there the number of districts that are meeting, the number of districts that are not meeting, and then the total count of districts. Remember, this is where you have the groups and the group size here. And then if you turn to the next page, we can look at the reading of 2015. 61% of districts meeting reading targets for American Indian students, 26% of districts meeting reading targets for white students.
Commissioner, since our time is flying quickly, perhaps members can study those slides on their own, and maybe you could move to the next most relevant for our information today.
Great. So then I'll take you to page 28. And
perfect. Thank you.
You can go through the data slides. And if you'd like, we can also do a presentation just on data and help
you
dig in that. So just in slide 28, I just wanted to show you the regional data for graduation rates and how they differ throughout the state for our student groups here and how they differ by region. And so we provided you the map so that you can see the map and then also see the region. And how they're performing, okay?
And members, so you can refer to the map that the commissioner included to double-check where these areas are. Thank you.
So then just finally, I want to talk just briefly about aligning ESSA and World's Best Workforce. So we talked about the goals of World's Best Workforce, addressing the needs in all of our schools. ESSA, only our federal accountability in those two schools that take Title I, which are mostly our elementary schools because some districts decide not to send the funding to high schools. So when you have the ESSA requirements of math and reading achievement, using a growth, English language learners, graduation rates, and then at least one other factor, and the World's Best Workforce goals on the other side of kindergarten readiness, third grade reading, achievement gap closure, graduation rates and college and career readiness, they're very similar. So what we'll be proposing to the work group is that the district, that at the accountability level for the state, we focus on the district goals and we focus on district level strategic planning through World's Best Workforce for our accountability system. It's the district then that holds their schools accountable and does the work in their schools because of local control and how Minnesota is situated. Previously, under federal No Child Left Behind, we held schools accountable, and we did not hold districts accountable, except under World's Best Workforce. And what I'll be talking to the stakeholder group about is kind of flipping that model and holding districts accountable and them holding their schools accountable. So it's a little bit different of a model. So we have the opportunity then to use our, for math and reading, we can strengthen our, instead of just third grade reading, we can strengthen and put all of our MMR over there into that. We could have our achievement gap measure be our closure for our English language development, our growth measures, our achievement gap growth measure, our focus rating, graduation rates are the same, and then our college and career ready, look at what that indicator is. So I'll stop there.
And Ms. Graff, we haven't heard from you, so would you share some of your insights here, because you've done a lot of this legwork.
And she's read all the plans too,
yes.
So it would be good.
Absolutely, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Thank you for having me. And I would just kind of echo the commissioner's comments about us transitioning to really more meaningful feedback around World's Best Workforce for districts. We've really, really been intentional the last year about making sure that we're very transparent up front around what the expectations are and what the criteria are for our reviews by providing them with a rubric, by providing them with a template. I've spent countless hours working with district superintendents and leadership teams on setting their goals. So to Representative Flanagan's question about how, you know, strengthening the goals and the the types of support that we're providing. We know that that's an area of need, and we want to make sure that we're building capacity within districts and within schools to set strong goals and share those with their community members and make sure that parents and families are involved with those goals and understanding progress as well. So I think over the course of the next year, when it comes to ESSA and World's Best Workforce, we have such a great opportunity to think coherently about this and build a system that, as the Commissioner mentioned, really makes sense for schools and for districts. So with that, I think that's all I really have to add.
And Ms. Graff, the superintendent meetings, is there usually a leader among that group or commissioner who could propel some of this continuity that we're working toward so that they have a clear understanding of how important it is to reach these goals?
Yeah, Madam Chair, I think that the regional superintendents really do work together closely. And I think, obviously, like I said before, some more than others. But I do think that the regional model is one that's really working well. Like Southwest Minnesota superintendents, they actually share a calendar and work
yes.
together around some of these work. Southeast Minnesota, same thing. So I think that we see them coming together more and more than they have in the past, and realizing that they can be more supportive of one another rather than the culture and climate that we had with open enrollment, where they really were more in siloed. So hopefully, instead of a competitive environment because of open enrollment, we'll see more of a collaborative environment among our school leaders and teachers.
Thank you very much for being here today, Commissioner. We appreciate your taking the time.
Madam Chair, I just have one other thing, if I might mention, about
Please.
Innovation zones. This was a law we worked on together a few years ago. And I won't be here because I'm going to have to leave to testify, but I do just want the committee to know that I'm very supportive of innovation zones and allowing and unleashing our school districts, especially our high-performing school districts, to do whatever it takes to be able to address the needs of our students and to have the flexibility. I currently believe that the bill that's going to be presented doesn't go far enough, and I understand the constraints of time. But if there are ways for us to think even further about unleashing our school districts and giving them more autonomy around certain guardrails, but if we could do that, I think we could see faster change for kids of color, for American Indian students, and our poor students, and better interventions if we allow them to have that kind of flexibility. So thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members, for giving me the time today.
Thank you very much, and thank you, Ms. Graff, as well. Now we're going to segue to innovation zones, although I know Representative LaRusso, did we not get to answer your question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. No, but it's too complicated. We don't have time
okay,
right now. Thank you.
Maybe you could communicate with the commissioner, and Ms. Graff is excellent. And before we hear from Mr. Corte, Representative Flanagan, tell us a little bit about yourself, the district you represent, and again, welcome.
Sure. So I represent St. Louis Park, Golden Valley, Medicine Lake, and Plymouth. I was elected last fall. I'm also a recovering school board member from Minneapolis Public Schools, and I spent some time living in that community. So I'm very excited to be here. I have a three-year-old daughter, Siobhan, and so I'm very interested in making sure that our educational system in Minnesota has what it needs to be successful. So thank
welcome
you.
Welcome to our committee. We appreciate having you here. Welcome, Mr. Corte, and you're going to take over now on innovation zones.
That's
and so, members, I believe this is the end of our PowerPoint, and I'm not sure if there are other handouts, but please proceed. Introduce yourself and begin.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Darren Corte. I'm an assistant commissioner at the Minnesota Department of Education. Thank you for having me today. There is another handout in your packet, I believe, which is the interim evaluation report that we recently conducted on the Innovation Pilot Program. So a little bit more detail in that than what's going to be in my presentation today, but happy to answer any questions as we move along. I'm here to talk about what is called in statute the Innovative Delivery of Education Services and Sharing of District Resources Pilot Project. Because it's kind of a mouthful, it's kind of been known more commonly as either the Innovation Pilot Project or the Innovation Zones Project. And what it is a five-year pilot project that was created to help districts work together to improve student and school outcomes by providing innovative education programs and activities and share district resources. The law itself calls out four different ways in which you can do that, and it talks about challenging programmatic options, professional development opportunities, increasing student engagement, and demonstrating efficiencies in financial and other services, so mainly sharing of resources. And just a little bit of legislative history on this. It was initially passed in 2012, and it was a one-time pilot project. There was a one-time application opportunity. I've cited the law there if you want to go back and look at the original language. But after the initial application went through, there was a lot of excitement and maybe some districts that have had some interest but missed that first application window, so came back through their associations and lobbied to in 2014 to have it modified into an ongoing annual application process. And again, the law is cited there if you want to go back and look at the language, but that's kind of the version that we're currently working under. The initial pilot projects will sunset on June 30th, 2018 under the statute, but if you're in a program or a partnership, you're allowed to continue that on if you'd like to. So in the initial application process for the starting in the 2013-14 school year cohort, there were two that were that applied and were approved. And just kind of as background for the approval process, we do have a stakeholder engagement group that is called out in the law that we engage, and they help us review the applications and make recommendations to the commission on whether or not to approve. But for this, for the initial cohort, there was Farmington and Spring Lake Park, and then a consortium of Southwest districts that are listed there. I am not going to go into a ton of detail about what was in their plans. That is listed in the evaluation report, and I understand that you have folks from Farmington here who can talk about some of the great work that they're doing with Spring Lake Park. And then just this last year, we had an application go through for the 2015-16 cohort, and you can see that there were also two new partnerships that were created there. I'm really excited about the work that they're starting up. And we've just closed the application window on March 1st, and we'll start going through applications for the next coming school year. So as part of the evaluation process, we were asked to engage the partnerships and have them create some recommendations on how they thought that the program could work a little bit better. And not surprisingly, the first thing that they had suggested was that they would really like to have some funding in order to support these partnership projects, in order to do some of the innovative things that they were looking at doing. There was maybe some financial incentive that could be created to increase interest in this program. We've had we've had five total applications. Four have been approved. One was withdrawn, especially because they didn't have the financial resources to move forward. So it was the top recommendation that came through out of that evaluation report. Another recommendation which came through, which I think that we were very interested in, was including post-secondary institutions, charter schools, and businesses in partnerships. If we are talking about innovation, and especially in the era of the focus on college and career success that we have, I think that makes a lot of sense to have those partnerships, or at least the option for those partnerships to exist, and to kind of formalize that in the statute. And then lastly, there is no authority, it's kind of a myth with the innovation zones that the commissioner has authority to waive federal or state statutory requirements under for partnerships that are in innovation zones. The way the statute was written, that's not exactly how it works. It's we do not have the authority to waive these license or statutory requirements, but that was one of the recommendations to give the commissioner the ability to provide some of that additional flexibility for approved folks that are in the zones that you heard the commissioner talk about. I think we'd want to put guardrails on that to make sure there's not any unintended consequences, but if we were to move forward with that, that was one of the recommendations from the partnerships. One other thing I might mention is because of the lack of ability to waive these statutory requirements, a lot of what districts proposed to do under the innovation zones, they actually could already do without commissioner approval through the joint powers process. Correct. But one of the interesting things that we've learned is that maybe the value of being in an innovation zone under the current construct isn't so much the flexibility that you get, but it's actually the ability to say that you're in the innovation zone, and it creates kind of a culture, an environment within the school of innovation, and allows administrators to work with their teachers and kind of free them up from the mindset of thinking within the box to being innovative and thinking outside of the box. So that was one of the more interesting things that we learned. So that completes my presentation, but would be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you, Mr. Cordy. And we have a couple of testifiers I'd like to call forth from Farmington School District, a principal and executive director of educational services. Please come forward to share with us your experience as part of an innovation pilot project. Welcome to the committee. Please say your name for the record and begin.
I'm Jason Berg. I'm the principal at Farmington High School.
And good morning. My name is Barb Dufferin. I'm the executive director of educational services for Farmington.
Please proceed, Ms. Dufferin.
Thank you. So the purpose of our testimony this morning is to support the recommendations that are put forth by the Department of Education. In particular, in your report, number four is the one that we're really speaking to, and it has to do with the flexibility that we think needs to be afforded the Innovation Zone districts, and specifically, particularly for the benefit of our teaching staff. So as we seek a more personalized learning environment that's built around student strengths and provides vehicles for just-in-time support, we are asking to be freed of the typical constraints. So for example, our application put forth a number of goals. Specifically, we want to create a continuous progress competency-based model. And the traditional concept of time and the way we use time in schools fails to recognize that students learn at different paces. And I think we just spoke about that, the commissioner spoke about that earlier when talking about the world's best workforce. We need to change those conditions so that learning remains the constant, and that time and structures and resources, both human and fiscal resources, are made variable to meet the student needs. We also looked at using, and we are using, powerful learning devices that eliminate the boundaries of time and space, providing anytime, anywhere learning opportunities. And so in order to do this, students will create personal learning networks and share and grow alongside each other. Additionally, by re-envisioning time and space in the classroom, we're looking for students to be able to work more independently and collaboratively alongside their teachers. And so those are our goals that we set forth, and we want to give us some specific examples of how we went about it and things that we ran into along the way.
Welcome, Mr. Burks, please.
I think the assistant commissioner kind of spoke to this a little bit in terms of being an innovation zone really did not allow us any special treatment to assist in the implementation of our work. He did speak to the fact of the mindset around innovation, and I think we've created that culture within our district and especially in our building in terms of trying to look at things and do things differently. But ultimately, we're still beholden to the typical constraints that all schools and school districts are held to. Some of the biggest things that we've run into in terms of trying to implement our work and look at doing things differently and transforming our system is the idea of seat time and academic support. We are still required to make sure that all students have 1,020 hours in the secondary building, regardless if they need more or they need less. And there's certain requirements on how those hours are accounted for, which we bump into in trying to give kids the support they need when they need it, knowing that not everybody needs the same amount of support at the same time. Sharing district resources, Spring Lake Park is our partner, and they do have some different things that we would like to tap into that we could share with them. Specifically their online learning program that would probably provide us the opportunity to share staff and share students between districts. And currently we would have to go through our own process to become an online learning institution. I'm not sure the exact term, sorry. But we'd have to go through that process when our partner district has already gone through that. You know, it'd be our want to be able to just join in with them since they are a partner district and go and use the process that they already have. And then finally is the idea of flexible learning days, hours, and targeted services. Currently under our system, no matter what we do, we really are waiting for kids to fail and then we remediate. If they fail, then we can access targeted service dollars. A big thing for us that Ms. Dufferin talked about was really making learning the constant and time the variable. So we do a lot more of giving incompletes and things like that. When kids aren't done with their work,
but that creates an issue because that doesn't create any additional funding. So students may be done with the class, but they need to continue to that work. And so to create time and space for that work to happen without any additional funding streams can become problematic. Now, we've worked through that through creating our schedule and some different things, but the reality is, because of these constraints and some of the things that we bump into, most of our energy is trying to figure out how to comply with the requirements and kind of get around them and jump over those hurdles rather than really allowing our staff to focus on supporting students. So to truly innovate, we need to allow our staff to kind of think outside of the current system and not create within the system. And the rules that exist there are to improve the current system. We really want to create a new system. And ultimately, I think the commissioner spoke to this before she left, but we would really like to see the Innovation Zone allow the commissioner to grant Innovation Zone districts a freedom from typical constraints. And that hasn't been the case for us. We recognize that the commissioner was also prevented from acting based on federal regulations. And with some of the federal regulations that have been lifted, we encourage legislature to provide the board of leadership to support the work of these Innovation Zone districts so we can truly do things differently and support our students.
Thank you, Mr. Berg. And we never intended when we implemented Innovation Zones that you would have all these barriers. So thank you for bringing them forward because we truly want our schools to work together and be as innovative as possible to help every child learn and succeed. Thank you very much. Representative Peterson has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I represent the Lake Pell area schools and I'm very excited to see how the Innovation Zones are working great there. But as you go through the process, it would be wonderful if you could continue to focus on cost-neutral strategies and for sustainability in the future so that other school districts could implement some of these great ideas as well. And then what kind of documentation are you doing so that other school districts could potentially copy or mimic some of the things that you're doing?
Any comment, Ms. Dufferin?
Well, I will say that I think what we have been doing, I guess I want to reiterate the point we're trying to make here, is that a number of the things that we have been doing are cost neutral, and however that we are spending a lot of time on our compliance, and that's what we're asking to be free. So we're making sure we have all the systems in place to comply, where if we didn't spend our time worrying so much about those things, the things we have been doing are cost neutral. So
thank you very much, both of you, for being here. Sorry that we have so little time, but I don't see any questions from members. Representative Seltzer.
Thank you.
One last question.
Thank you, Chair.
Because we do have another testifier or so from the World's Best Workforce.
Thank you very much, and thank you for the good work that you're doing. And it's great that you're creating this culture. I think that's wonderful. I'm wondering, and I was just glancing through the report, so maybe it's in there and I missed it, but how is this new culture affecting student achievement, and what metrics are you using to measure student achievement since you're taking a different approach?
Mr. Berg or Ms. Dufferin?
Well, at this point, we have the same typical student achievement measures that you all use
required.
Here.
Yes.
We are gathering some data around student engagement using Hanover Research Group. That's a group that's been working with us on that. And so at this point, as early as we are in the Innovation Zone, that would be the first thing that we'll be able to share with you. And then again, what we're looking to do also is do as many other districts are doing and create the more authentic assessment models that we're all trying to move towards in a personalized learning environment. We know we're not alone on this. We're working with a number of districts on this. Eastern Carver County is one in particular. But those would be other measures to show the authentic assessment and the authentic learning for students.
I think a second piece, too, is just preparing kids for when they leave our building, whether they're going to a four-year school, two-year school, military, or workforce, that they have those intangible skills that aren't always taught in a secondary building. We've been very based on compliance, telling kids what to do, where to go. They have very little opportunity to make decisions. And if we want kids to be good decision makers, we have to give them those opportunities. And so we want to, probably 5-6 years from now, we'll be able to look at our SLEDS data and see what kids look like when they choose those schools. Are they able to get through sooner? Do they need to take as many remedial classes? Things like that. Some ancillary data that's just grade level specific. Commissioner Casilius talked about ninth grade being super important and making sure those kids don't get credit deficient through some of the work that we've done with our ninth grade math. We've reduced the number of failures from just over 6% to less than 1%. So I think we see some good things happening through there. But again, it's, you know, you have the stuff up here about funding, and our business manager is probably not going to like it if I say funding's not the biggest thing. I think for us, the biggest thing is to be able to release from some of these constraints so that we can allow our teachers to really work with kids and make those individual for students in their classroom at that student level and free them up to do that without running into some of these things.
Thank you. Thank you very much, both of you. And I'd like to call down Julian McGee, who's here on behalf of Minnesota School Counselors from the Moose Lake School District to close off our meeting this morning. Welcome to our committee. Please say your name for the record and begin.
Jillian McGee. Good morning, Chair Erickson and members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Jillian McGee, and I'm a school counselor in the Moose Lake School District and Northeast Division President of the Minnesota School Counseling Association. As you discuss the world's best workforce today, I hope you'll consider the important role that school counselors and other support staff have in preparing our students for future success. I want to thank Commissioner Concilius for acknowledging the work school counselors do for our students every day and also the need for them in our schools. School counselors are licensed professionals who, by Minnesota state law, must hold a master's degree from an accredited program and have completed hundreds of hours of supervised internship. Our level of education means that we are uniquely qualified to help students with a number of issues, which include college preparedness and career readiness, mental health, social and emotional needs, and also academic support and guidance. Every school counselor's highest priority is the well-being of our students, each individual student in our school. On any given day, a school counselor may be helping one student map out a plan for academic success in high school and guiding them through college application processes, while another student is struggling with an issue at home or a bullying problem at school and needs someone to talk to. School counselors also work collaboratively with teams of professionals, such as our school nurses, social workers, psychologists, and even chemical dependency counselors in schools, to ensure that each student has the support and resources they need to be successful both in and out of the classroom. I'm currently working with a family in which neither parent has a high school diploma or a GED. The oldest son is in prison, and the two younger children are in ninth and sixth grade, are both high risk for dropping out of school. I've been working with the family for the last 5 years, and the ninth grader, who was already reported to the county for truancy issues in fifth grade, is now on an individualized education plan and is finding success in his first year at high school. The sixth grader is currently receiving additional support to lower his risk for truancy and dependency issues and disciplinary issues. This family, for the first time, has had a positive view of education and also is beginning to see the value in it in their family. Research has shown a dramatic benefit when students have access to school counselors and comprehensive support services. These benefits, I think, align closely with the world's best workforce goals and can help major strides toward closing those achievement gaps, including the higher post-secondary enrollment and career readiness, increased school attendance rates, ACT scores, and graduation rates, and increased math and reading proficiency levels, and also decreased disciplinary actions and suspension rates. Unfortunately, Minnesota is failing to provide our students with adequate access to school counselors and other support services. The average school counselor in our state, for example, is responsible for meeting the needs of nearly 750 students, resulting in enormous and often unmanageable workloads. As a result, students are forced to wait days or weeks to get help and support that they deserve. Just this week, Minnesota Public Radio released research showing that compared to all other states, Minnesota ranks dead last in the percentage of education funding we spend on support services. Just 2.6%, which is less than half of the national percentage. The problem isn't that we don't have licensed school counselors looking for jobs either. A number of higher education institutions in Minnesota are preparing school counselors, but we are losing these trained professionals to other states where school counseling jobs are more available. We have proposed a solution with bipartisan support called the Supporting Our Students Act, House File 2045, which would provide school districts with mandate-free optional matching grant program to invest in hiring additional student support staff. understand that this is a policy committee and that our proposal is a financial proposal, but wanted to be sure to take this opportunity to speak briefly with members of this committee about the role that school counselors play in preparing our students to be the world's best workforce. For far too long, students in Minnesota have faced an extreme shortage of school counselors and support staff. We can and we must do better if we expect to make progress toward closing our achievement gap and preparing our students for future success. Thank you for supporting school counselors and all the critical support service professionals that our students deserve every day. I would be happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Thank you very much, Ms. McGee, and thank you for taking time out from your school to come and testify to us. This is something we'll be discussing in the future, I'm sure, and especially in the Finance Committee. So thank you very much for being here. Members, keep in mind that, and if you're not aware of it, we will hear the audit on the Board of Teaching and Licensing Division on Tuesday. We'll also hear it in Finance today, I realize that, but we're going to hear it in Policy because there are a lot of policy issues that we need to deal with, and it's very likely that we will meet Tuesday evening as well at 5 o'clock in this room. So with that said, members, this meeting is adjourned.